What's going on, guys? Welcome to another episode of Bro History. It's Henry Zamota, and we have Danny Abdeljabbar. It kind of looks like from here you have been maintaining your beard a little bit more than usual, have you?
Or oh,
no?
Yeah.
Am I just making that up?
Yeah, no, I've been straightening it. You know, it's just something that I like to do when I'm bored. Just straighten it.
Straighten it.
Yeah, you know, I've got a comb and everything.
Do you use special beard shampoo?
No, but I have special beard wax and oils.
Oh. Oh. Seems like too much maintenance. See, where I'm at now, I haven't shaved in about 5 to 6 days, and I'm at to the point where my face, I start scratching like I'm Tyrone Biggins. So I need to shave probably tonight before I go to bed. Like, this is how, this is only, I can grow the beard. I just can't handle the inconvenience and how.
You can't handle the beard.
You can't handle it. You may, it's one thing to grow a beard, but you got to handle that motherfucker.
Right.
I can't do it. My face is too sensitive. But it's looking good. Next episode, you should come out with like a full-flung Johnny Depp Pirates of the Caribbean type of like braids in your beard.
I can do it, and I also have.
Why not?
I've been Captain Jack Sparrow for Halloween once. So, if you remember, actually, you probably wouldn't remember that. That was before we met. But yeah, I can probably do that. Should I do one of the podcasts, just like do random live stream in one of the random ridiculous costumes that I do?
Yeah, I'll dress up like Tarzan. I still have a costume. I still have my Tarzan costume. You know what everyone should do?
What?
For these face masks. So when you go outside, instead of wearing like the surgeon mask,
or just wear a Halloween mask.
Just wear a Halloween mask.
That counts, so if right?
That counts. It covers your face. So whenever you, if you walk outside and you run to the grocery store, everyone's like, you know, there's a Freddy Krueger, there's a werewolf, there's a vampire. There's
I love
like
this
pinhead,
idea.
There's Pinhead. There's a. You know, some Resident Evil character. There's zombies. And then when aliens look down on Earth and they're like, you know, when they, because recently there have been UFO sightings, right?
Yep, that's true. When they're
monitoring us, they'll be like, oh, look, it's a planet full of monsters. I guess we won't invade.
Well, depending on what the aliens
there's
look
Dracula.
Like. Depending on what the aliens look like. They might already think we look like monsters, so.
Specimens is probably the correct term.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, let's get started. Thanks for anyone who's joining us right now. We're doing this podcast live. It's Thursday right now. It's Thursday night, so we usually do these on Wednesdays, but we both got held up, and we honestly didn't really have too much time to catch up on the news, but. The first thing I wanted to bring up before we, you know, jumped into some of the main topics is just some, like, you know, some updates on things in the Middle East that we've been talking about. I don't know if you saw today, but Lebanon's economy crashed today.
Yeah, you were telling me about that earlier.
So I guess, you know, the Ponzi scheme that pegged the Lebanese pound to the U.S. dollar has finally fallen apart. And the government, they came out with their economic data, and their GDP, I think, decreased by 6.9% in the last year, and then they expect it to decrease this year by 13.8%.
Whoa.
And 48% of the people who live in Lebanon are underneath the poverty line, the Lebanese poverty line. And you know what's funny? There was protests all year, or all of last year, the end of last year. There was these raging protests, and they were peaceful protests. They weren't riots where people were killing each other. However, this is something that was going on. Like, did you see any of those videos where these protests would be like a bunch of people dancing and like twerking?
Yeah,
in
totally.
Lebanon?
Yeah,
they seemed kind of fun.
But, yeah.
Now everyone, I guess,
it's not
had
fun
to
anymore.
go back indoors for coronavirus, and now we're. Now, since things are a little bit, like the lockdown is less restrictive, people are going out to protest again. Hmm. But I guess essentially what happened is that, what's going to happen is that they're going to be forced to take an IMF loan. And their pound fell from $1.50 per U.S. to now below $4.
Whoa.
So essentially, if you had money in a Lebanese bank, you probably lost all of your money.
If you're listening to this show and you had money in a Lebanese bank...
Well, something that's interesting about Lebanon is that Lebanon has a really big diaspora.
Yeah, for sure.
Because of the Lebanese Civil War in the 80s. And there's a lot of people who have money, like Lebanese people who are either in Canada or America or Europe who have their money in Lebanese banks. So it's going to hit those people. But yeah, it's just, I mean, this is something that's been escalated because of COVID-19, but they were having economic problems prior to this. But I found it interesting. If you guys are interested, I know there's a lot of people who are interested in like the Federal Reserve who listen to this podcast. I would do researching on that because a lot of it has to do with their federal banking system,
right,
that they have in place. But another interesting thing that happened, this happened in that area, is that in Iraq, they chose their new prime minister today.
Yep, heard that too. So what was the guy's name again?
So Mustafa al-Kadhimi, mm-hmm, who is, I guess he's kind of a technocrat, where, you know, he has a skilled background. I honestly don't know that much about him. However, what was interesting to me is that I saw two supporting tweets. And two people support this guy, and one is Mike Pompeo, and then the other comes from Iran. So it seems that he's in favor. I mean, the U.S. and Iran actually backed this guy, which is nothing new,
mm-hmm,
given the last, you know, 20 years of Middle Eastern history of the U.S. and Iran supporting the same people in Iraq, only to fight and antagonize each other everywhere else in the world. But I guess things have changed since Trump has become president, because now Iran is, you know, officially an enemy in Iraq. But what's interesting is that this guy is going to have a really tough job. Like, that's got to be the worst prime minister job,
yeah,
in the world right now.
Yep.
Like, that's the last job that you'd ever want to take. Like, you're becoming the new prime minister. You have social disorder, clear social disorder.
Right.
You have a regional power along with a superpower, both inserted into your country, who hate each other.
Right.
And you have to balance out those relationships. Your main source of revenue has declined
dramatically
because of low oil prices.
Right.
And most likely, they're going to have to take an IMF. Like, all these Middle Eastern countries that have always tried to, you know, these countries that are either exporters of minerals or oil, you know, besides Saudi Arabia, they're going to be forced to take more IMF loans. You know, Iran took their first IMF loan ever.
Even though they didn't need it.
In decades. Even though they essentially did not need it.
According to them.
But when you take a... If Iraq takes another IMF loan, I believe this would be their first one. That would come with conditions from the U.S., and those conditions are going to be anti-Iranian conditions.
Of course, yeah.
But on the flip side, if the U.S. wants Iraq to take a position against, you know, Iran and the Iraqi militias that Iran sponsors, they're going to end up, the new prime minister, Kadhimi, he's going to end up losing support from his own parliament.
Right.
That also depends on Iran for energy.
Right.
So he's in a quagmire of all quagmires. That's going to be a tough job, but apparently he's pretty popular. And from, you know, the brief skimming I've done about him is that he comes, he's like known as somebody who gets the job done.
Hmm.
He's not a bureaucrat. Type corrupt monster, but maybe he is.
Maybe he'll become one.
Maybe he is. We'll find out. Or, right, you know, I'm sure someone listening to it will be like, "Are you fucking kidding me? That guy is a piece of shit."
I mean, look, you brought up a good question. It's like, you know, this guy gets shit done. But my question is, like, what is he going to do first, right? What thing is he going to get done first? Like, where do you even start? I mean, you know, obviously the oil prices, being on the brink of an IMF loan and being, like, supported by two antagonistic, you know, powers, both regionally and internationally. And then on top of that, of course, there's the coronavirus stuff, which is not over yet. And Iran has a very, very bad problem there, which they share a border with. And I guess, like, to a lesser extent, there's, like, the fallout of the civil war in Syria, you know. There's still terrorism in the region. Although I'm really curious to see, like, how, if terrorism has gone down.
It's actually been going up in Iraq. It's been going up in Iraq lately. Yeah.
Huh. I guess they don't care for the social distancing, huh?
From what I've been seeing, that there actually has been, like, a spike in ISIS over the past couple of weeks.
I wonder why that is.
So, I couldn't tell you. You know, part of me will say that it's because they want to. Because he's pro, he has a good relationship with Iran, but, you know, there's probably more to the story. It's probably just a pretty good time to move around if you're a jihadist, or if you're a jihadist militia.
Yeah, well, if you want to go, like, the locked up.
Yeah, if you want to be a you know, an Occam's razor guy, you know, this would be the time to move around the country unprovoked a little bit, or with a little less provocation.
Yeah.
But the main thing that, you know, I wanted to talk, and this kind of transitions into, like, the main topic of today's show, is what happened in Saudi Arabia today, where the United States, you know, we're allies with Saudi Arabia, the Magic Kingdom, which is probably the better term, and that's
Magic Kingdom.
The Magic Kingdom has been a term that. Has been used to describe them within the State Department for decades. They call it the Magic Kingdom, not to be confused with the one in Orlando. This one is more magic. So the U.S. has a bunch of weapons and high-tech anti-aircraft systems to protect oil processing facilities and oil fields and the eastern part of Saudi Arabia, where all the oil fields are. And the reason to have them there is because, well, one of their processing facilities was bombed only about, what, 4 months ago at this point? I'm losing right. track of time. I completely lost track of time, so this may
some
be more
time
like
ago.
Yeah. I think about 6 months ago. It was the end of last year. There was an attack on a Saudi oil processing facility, their largest one.
Aramco, right?
Aramco, but that's their national oil company.
Right, right.
But there were, you know, there were two narratives that were going on at this time. Narrative one was that Iran did it, and Iran did it with a cruise missile, which honestly is feasible to me. Like, I still think that's probably. Sounds like it could have happened. The other narrative is that the Houthis did it with their remote drones,
right.
That they flew over the Saudi border. They flew over the border and they were able to, you know, get behind and the processing facility and blow a big ass hole in it. And I guess the third narrative is that they both did it, but the Houthis claimed responsibility for doing it.
Right.
So. You know, there's that. You know, they did say they did do it. There could be political reasons for that. Who knows? I think most likely they probably did it together. That's honestly kind of like what I think that they were both involved in it. Iran denied it. Houthis said they did do it, but I think they probably did it together. Now, what's interesting is that right now, I mean, there had just been an oil war. Between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and Russia, where Russia was producing more, Saudi wanted them to produce them less. Saudi, being the biggest oil producer in the world, said, "Hey, you can't beat us this game," and they started flooding the market. when they flooded the market. That hurt U.S. oil. Trump said stop. Then COVID-19 reached a new level, caused the demand of oil to go down. Then all of a sudden we have negative oil prices.
Right.
Like, so with that, and with, you know, the, this is really killing like the oil industry, you know, in Texas and Louisiana, you know, our domestic, you know, fracking companies, you know, energy, our domestic energy companies, you know, those politicians of those states, they have an interest in protecting those industries. And Trump said to Mohammed bin Salman, he's like, hey, if you keep on pumping oil, if you don't cease the production of oil and start raising the prices, like usually, you know, the big crises in our lifetime, not in our lifetime, we weren't born yet, but in the 70s, the problem was that they weren't pumping enough oil,
right?
That they had an embargo. Now it's the opposite. There's too much. So Trump is like, hey, man, I can't, if you guys are going to keep on pumping oil, I'm not going to be able to protect you from the politicians, the congressmen who represent these oil companies in these states. They're going to go push for anti-Saudi legislation. And that's also, you got to take in mind that those are typically Republican states who are
right.
going to be more supportive of things like military interest in Saudi Arabia and mm-hmm. Israel. So doing that was kind of risky politically in the U.S. Now, Trump made the decision to remove their Patriot missile systems from Saudi Arabia, which protect those fields and those facilities. And, you know, to be completely honest, they're vulnerable. Like, they've shown to be vulnerable. The right. reductions, apparently, though, were based on an assessment that Tehran is no longer a threat to U.S. interest. That's the word. That's the word on the block.
Really? Just like that?
Yeah. Don't worry. They're not a threat anymore.
I mean, on the one hand, you know, going back to the Houthi thing and
we just got to worry about their proxies. All right. It's like on one hand, there's like two narratives. Like one narrative is like whatever narrative fits the, you know, specific circumstance that they're in right now. You know, Iran is a menace. They're destabilizing the Middle East. They're going to destroy the global oil supply. They're striking Aramco right from Tehran.
Now they're like, go for it. Destroy the
oil. They work hand in hand with their proxy networks and Hezbollah and the Houthis in Iran. And so on one hand, there's this threat that's causing so much terror in the Middle East. And I mean, they definitely do have a lot of influence and do have a lot of militias that are traveling around. And I think that they're closer with the Houthis, or at least they had been closer with the Houthis more so than ever previous to the war in Yemen. However, it's just funny that, you know, you're taking these missile systems out of Saudi Arabia, saying that Tehran is no longer a threat to U.S. interest.
Yeah,
but
I mean,
you've been spending so much time pumping this big bad boy up, where it's like, you know, why don't we put more Patriot missile systems in there? So,
and they've been moving troops.
My question is:
is this
punishment? Is this punishment to Saudi Arabia?
For what? For the oil issue?
Yeah, for the oil issue. For not making production cuts in time to save oil, U.S. oil industries.
I mean, that seems likely. But I mean, like in practice, though, the Patriot missiles didn't really help Saudi Aramco facility when it got hit by apparently the Houthis, maybe the Iranians, maybe both. You know, like those Patriot missiles didn't do shit against that. So if it is a punishment, like how strong a punishment is it? You know, it's more like symbolic, if anything, you know.
We're taking our missile system elsewhere now.
Well, they really are.
Well, let's talk about where, you know, because there's a pretty big, you know, for people like us, you know, who try to, you know, recommend or endorse more responsible statecraft. You know, we like the news of soldiers being moved out of the Middle East.
Right.
However, and that's a trend that's been going on in Afghanistan, in Saudi Arabia. Soldiers are leaving the Middle East, or at the very least being shuffled around. We're now closer than ever to an actual peace in Afghanistan, which is great. Now, in Saudi Arabia, though, I feel like this is more so a punishment. But can you – now, you were doing research on this. Can you dive in here and explain maybe where these are going, or – you know, what's the deal with these Patriot missile systems and where they may end up in the world?
Well, you know, I said that to you earlier today, more as a joke. So specifically, these Patriot missiles aren't necessarily going anywhere. Where about things that I want to talk about later, but it's ironic to see that we're pulling out land-based missile systems from Middle East, specifically Saudi Arabia, when at the same time we are increasing our land-based missile systems elsewhere in the world, and that's in China. Now, specifically, we're definitely not moving those Patriot missiles from Saudi Arabia to like the Asia Pacific, but we are kind of boosting up our arms here. So there was a special report in Reuters here that claims that the U.S. is now basically rearming itself in the Asia-Pacific theater. And they are doing this for a very specific reason, and it's to basically counter China's huge missile supremacy in the region. And I've had my finger on this pulse for a little while, but it has become very, very clear after reading this report and others that China might have a leg up on us in the short term. How much have you heard about this?
You're filling me in right here. I've been hearing about like the missile system movement, but I haven't heard the take that they have a leg up on us.
Yeah.
Do you mean a leg up on us on just like what's on the ground there, or?
Yep.
Because the U.S. Because what's Navy wise, like cruiser wise.
I got some interesting stuff on Navy too, but it's all with a grain of salt. So let's get started.
Well, can you explain to us about just U.S. mm-hmm. naval supremacy in that area over the past couple of years at the very
forever.
Least.
Forever. For our ever,
starting with the casino ship that they purchased and turned into
Okay, so fun. I'm jumping around a little bit here, but evidently, and this is true, China's got the biggest navy in the world right now. Right, they might not have the most well-equipped navy, but they have more vessels, right? Right now, and they're definitely bumping that up by a whole lot. I joked a while ago when we had a kind of conversation, a podcast about aircraft carriers, and I joked about China's carrier, because what they did when they got their hands on their first carrier, they didn't build one themselves. They actually purchased one from Ukraine, an old like Soviet style one, and it's one of those ones with the ski jump at the top, and the ski jump at the end is basically like an old archaic method to launch planes. Like you need a slope to get them off the ground. So they're not very effective. But the way that they purchased it was really funny, because they actually set up a shell corporation and lied to the Ukraine and said, "Oh, no, we're a casino company, and we're going to transform this old, aircraft carrier into a giant floating casino." And then they got it. And then they were like, psych, we're making this into an aircraft carrier. So they started retrofitting it. But because they lied, the Ukrainians aren't helping them, with logistics. And, they never had an aircraft carrier before, so they don't know how to fly and land and take off airplanes from an aircraft carrier. So these poor, like, Chinese, Air Force pilots, they have to simultaneously figure out how to do it and write the playbook on how to do it, which is fucking dangerous. If you ever think about how, just the act of landing or taking off, specifically landing, like you don't come in slow, you have to come in hot, And there's an arresting gear, basically like a little rope or whatever that kind of grabs the plane so that it doesn't go flying off the deck afterwards. And you're doing this on a ship that's moving through the sea, right? And sometimes wobbling about because of the waves. It's a very, very complex system. And I, you know, I'm sure China would never admit to like crashing planes testing this out, but I can imagine that they fucked it up a few times before they figured it out, if they figured it out. Anyway, so they've been building up their navy for sure, you know, and they're really trying to press their strength, especially in the southeast. What do they call that? The fucking East China Sea, South China Sea. Help me out here. It's the South China Sea. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, you're right.
But really, where their power is just kind of scary right now is with their intermediate and short medium range land-based missile launchers. So they have thousands of them, lots and lots and lots of them. And you know, why is this a problem for us? Well, because their range allows them to strike, you know, our navy. It doesn't allow them to strike our mainland, but our super carriers, things like that, you know, our carrier groups, any naval vessel, you know, that comes anywhere close to the mainland is in striking range of these. And they've been setting up these fake-ass islands in the South China Sea to, like, basically claim, you know, sovereignty over them. And they just put missile launchers on them all over the place, like ground-based missile launchers. And that effectively gives them some strength in the region because, you know, it used to be prior when, you know, China or North Korea or, you know, anyone in the region was acting up, we just sent a super carrier group over there and they shut up because, you know, who wants a squadron of, like, you know, F-35s over their country? You know, like, that's scary as shit. So the ground-based missile launchers, like, these are this is kind of a big struggle that we're having right now, because previously we've been in the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, or the INF, right? And what and this was between the United States and Russia, like, post-Cold War, well, during Cold War, really. And it was a way to basically ban Russia and the U.S. from creating land and using land-based missiles, cruise missiles and missile launchers, that had a range of 500 to 1,000 kilometers, which is 300 to 600 miles, or short, medium-range ones, which have a range of 1,000 to 5,500 miles kilometers, which is 600 to 3,400 miles. And that's important because what they were trying to set up was a situation where, you know, the U.S. wasn't creating a short-range missile that they, or a medium-range missile that they can set up in, say, Germany or, like, the eastern states that we, you know, like Ukraine or something like that, and do land-based nuclear strikes. And same thing for Russia, right? They didn't want Russia setting up, you know, short-range or medium-range missile systems and hit parts of Eastern Europe or even Western Europe, for that matter. And so this treaty that we were in for a while basically prevented us from creating and developing and deploying these systems. Although I have a sneaking suspicion that we always had them in the first place. We always kept it super hush-hush. But kind of recently, Trump, in 2018, in October 2018, he decided to withdraw the U.S. from the treaty. And the reason why was because he said that the Russians weren't complying. He's probably right about that, but also it's a weak answer. And when it happened, I remember covering this and talking about it, and I was feeling pretty upset about it because I was like, why are we now just going to go ahead and increase our arms race? Like, that doesn't sound like a very good idea. But reading this again from the context of China, it's starting to make more sense. I still don't like it, but it's starting to make more sense because China wasn't in the INF, right? They weren't in this treaty. They were allowed to build as many fucking missiles as they wanted to, medium, short, long, doesn't matter. They can make them because they weren't in this treaty. And so in that time, they've been able to amass a massive amount of these missile launchers. And, you know, we talked a little bit when we were talking about, like, aircraft carriers and strike groups and things like that, that, you know, a missile launcher with a 800-mile range could hit a, you know, a cruise carrier strike group that's, like, way offshore. And because they can do that, it forces that carrier strike group to stay farther and farther away from the Chinese mainland, so that they're not in danger, right? The problem there is it kind of makes an aircraft carrier obsolete, because the airplanes that are on the aircraft carrier don't have enough range to fly 1,000 miles in both directions to, you know, to do a sortie, right? So it kind of like renders our power there kind of not useless, but it definitely threatens it. And so we're trying to build up all these missiles, and it's really threatening our the United States's like grip on the region in terms of like military power, especially in disputes of the South China Sea. And you know, since pretty much August 2019, we formally withdrew from that and off to the races. Like we're at it. So apparently the Pentagon wants to arm Marines with versions of the Tomahawk cruise missile, which is normally launched from U.S. warships, but they're putting it on like land-based launchers. And we're also developing a bunch of like long-range anti-ship missiles, both for air and sea. Basically we're trying to take the tactics that China has been doing and turn it on their head, which is basically set up a bunch of fucking missiles in the region so that we can suppress their admittedly massive, not very well equipped Navy. What are your thoughts on that?
So I guess my question is, are like, all right, so let me just make sure that I'm following you right now. So
sure,
this treaty that Trump left is the Obama treaty from 2010 with U.S. and Russia.
The INF treaty?
Yeah. Are we talking about the New START treaty?
No. The INF treaty started in 1987, in December 1987, and it was signed by Reagan and Gorbachev.
To the treaty with Obama.
No. And we pulled out of that one too.
No, we did pull out of that one, but
now so Reagan and Gorbachev signed this treaty in 87 to basically say like, all right, let's chill out on making intermediate range nuclear missile launchers, like ground based missiles. It conveniently did leave out like air based and naval based ones, but there were just like no ground based ones.
So, like, what is in the Chinese Navy? Like, what? How are they ill-equipped?
Well,
like,
they're ill-equipped.
Like, what?
Yeah. So, and this is largely my opinion, but it's based on like information that I've been reading about. But they're ill-equipped because one, they don't have nuclear-powered like vessels, right? So, you know, a big strength of our strike groups, as an example, is that you know they can go on largely indefinitely. Like they would have to stop and get like supplies and shit every now and again, but they can go on for a very, very long time. And nuclear powered, as an example, attack submarines are quiet. They're very, very quiet as opposed to very, very noisy, you know, diesel powered or diesel electric Chinese subs, right? So while they might have more vessels, like more people, more units in the sea, you know, they've got frigates and destroyers and battleships and things like that. They have one aircraft carrier, which, as we just pointed out, is old and ill-equipped. And they have, I think they're building a second one right now. But where they have strength a lot is in their littoral class ships, L-I-T-T-O-R-A-L, which is like, you know, close to the shore range ships. So they're not like deep water ships. I mean, they could go into deep waters, but they operate in the you know, in and around the shoreline to defend themselves. But by the time we get that close, you know, we're also in range of all of their intermediate range missile systems. Like, so we're fucked, you know? We can't really get that close to their shores. Now, they're ill-equipped because the armaments on those ships, their propulsion systems, and just the technology that they have around them is just in open blue sea, like in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, they're going to get wrecked by the United States. But close to shore, where they have cover from their from their missile launchers, like, they can do some damage. And they've got a lot of ships. Does that make sense?
No, it makes perfect sense. So I mean, they just the volume is going to do enough damage to, at the very least, have some regional influence and, you know, some regional influence in their own waters.
Right, we're not going to fuck with them, you know, like in regional waters, and this is, well, especially, I mean,
important. There's no military solution with China. There's a bunch of flexing solutions, but there's no actual military solution between both the U.S. and China. They're both nuclear armed. They both have nuclear warheads. There's not going to be a realistic invasion or fight between U.S. over some stupid island in the South Pacific. I would highly doubt it. And, I mean, if there's not a military solution in Iran, there's no military solution in China. And the chances are, if China wanted to declare war on the U.S., they would just stop lending us money.
I mean, they don't really have that much of our debts. They really don't.
They do have a high percentage of our bonds, of our treasury bonds.
If
the U.S. default, let's just say if the U, because a lot of senators are talking, like Lindsey Graham, I heard him the other day. He was like, the U.S. should just default on our loans to China. A lot of these people are proposing two things: defaulting on our loans. On our debt to China, which would hurt the value of a dollar, right? Because less people would want to buy dollars, knowing that the U.S. could default on their debt. Like, it would just cause, it would just make it more risky in the long run. And then also, they said they were talking about having individual families or individual lawsuits against China, like how we had individual lawsuits against Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, nations are supposed to have immunity because
from individual lawsuits, right?
From individual lawsuits, mainly because it's impossible to have a fair court.
Right.
Like, you can't.
Who's going to preside?
You
over
can't
that,
sue.
Right?
You can't sue China because there's going to be a bias in both systems. Like, you know, there can't be a Chinese lawsuit against an American government because, you know, the Chinese, the bias from the whatever government or whatever court is going to be so strongly in the home nation. So, I mean, that's why why countries have sovereign immunity. So I don't think those are actual solutions. Maybe flexing nuts is something that we could do, but I mean, I don't think that the U.S. is gonna go to war.
While I agree, and I think that we definitely don't have like an all-out war plan, like that would never work out. I mean, it wouldn't work out with Iran. Why would it work out with China? What we do have are active plans that we're doing right now to put military pressure on China. And they have similar plans against us. So right now what we're doing is we're trying to put missiles, ground-based launch missiles, to counter their missiles and basically do the same thing that they're doing, but in their home court, right? So right now that we're completely unchained from the INF treaty, we can build these missiles, we can deploy these missiles. And, you know, obviously we have strong ties with Japan. We have fairly strong ties with Taiwan. But also we're looking to, you know, move into a lot of the archipelago islands around Chinese coastal waters. So places like the Philippines they're all going after those islands and shit. And so what the plan right now is to stockpile a bunch of missiles, like in the short term. I think they're trying to buy 53 of these Tomahawk missiles, ground-based Tomahawk missiles, for the Marines to deploy. Apparently, they're going to be like mini ship killers, which is interesting because it feels like they're taking a page out of the Millennium Challenge and saying, instead of having these large warships, we're just going to do small amphibious assault ships and launch ship-killing missiles at them, which is interesting. But if the United States goes through with its plan, basically what they're going to do is line the coastal waters in the areas that we have like influence over with ground-based intermediate range missiles, which would effectively combat their navy, their large navy, and it puts the same pressure on them as it does on us in terms of like how we can operate in those waters. So it would rebalance the scales there a bit. Now China's trying to do the same exact thing, right? So China just recently conducted an exercise outside of Taiwan. So in the south and east of Taiwan, they did major military exercises with their navy, basically flexing their dick muscles there, showing off that like they can do whatever the fuck they want in the area, and kind of Taiwan.
So let me just like make sure that I'm following you, and other people are following you as well.
Sure.
The U.S. and China are basically kind of scrambling for land to put weapons on.
Yep. 100%.
And China has been making they've been building islands from scratch
just like, to do that.
Mm-hmm. Just to put weapons on them.
Correct. All right.
So they're in a scramble would be the best way to say it for what any land that they can take, mm-hmm. like what
or that they can influence.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what is the U.S. looking for? What is China looking for? Just anything that is that they can get some type of influence, either through their, you know, their monetary system or, you know, whatever influence that a government could put on a smaller nation.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, one of the main like first island chains that the United States is eyeing to start putting missiles is in the control or in the sphere of the Philippines. But we're having a little bit of trouble with that, actually, on this first phase, because the president, Rodrigo Duterte, he's basically been distancing himself from the United States policy and forming closer ties with China, both economically and on other points. And this is pretty important because there are some strategically important like islands in the Philippines that we could be utilizing to secure shipping routes, but also to be able to like... do military operations around. So, you know, right now Duterte is like the first big obstacle for the United States in terms of this plan to start arming the shit out of, you know, these islands surrounding China with intermediate range missiles. So if we can't figure that out, it might be kind of difficult. Other options are...
It sounds like World War II.
It does. It honestly really does, which it scares me a bit because, you know... Like, I understand the strategy, and I understand, like, the United States... I wouldn't say we feel threatened by it, but we feel less powerful, and they want to tip the scales back towards the United States. But I think it's dangerous what they're doing, because what... And I hate, like, siding with China on this, but the one guy... Let me try and find this quote.
Well, I'll add. Basically, yeah, like, all the foreign policy realists... / war hawks, like the people who consider themselves, I would say, a foreign policy realist who go by that definition, they've all been saying, like, we got to get our guys out of the Middle East and put them in Asia. Right. China is the real menace right here. Right. It's not the Arabs or the Muslims. It's the Chinese and the Russians. We need to start diverting our troops and our power from the Middle East, from you know, Qatar and from, you know, the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz to the South Pacific to combat China's spread over there.
Right.
And, you know, prevent them from building new islands and from, you know, becoming the new Japanese empire.
Right. You know, and I found that quote, and it's hard to argue against this particular line of logic, but Chinese foreign ministry drew a distinction between the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, arsenal of missiles, and the planned U.S. deployment. It said Chinese missiles were located in its territory, especially short and medium range missiles, which cannot reach the mainland of the United States. This is fundamentally different from the U.S., which is vigorously pushing forward deployment. In other words, we're pushing to put missile launchers in not our territory that can hit them, right? So we're kind of the aggressors here in that respect.
But if there is a radar system that goes into a sovereign country's territory, doesn't that cause a bunch of legal problems?
Well, it's not a radar system. It's a missile system. Of course, there's radar associated to it. But we're not talking about like Patriot missiles where it's looking to defend a particular point, right? These are offensive missiles, right? These are ground-based missile launchers that have a range between, let's say, 300 and, you know, 1,000 miles, right? And these devices can be set up in these like archipelagos, in these islands off the coast of China, and be able to hit mainland China, but more importantly, be able to hit naval assets in the seas around the coast of China. China isn't like that very much, and their logic makes sense. You know, they're saying, "Hey, you guys, you know, we weren't a part of the IMF. Like, we could build whatever we want, and we built it, and we kept it on our mainland to protect ourselves, right? As a deterrence for ourselves. You guys, on the other hand, just dropped out of that treaty and are now suddenly deciding to put a bunch of missile launchers on our doorstep. Fuck you guys, you know." I'm not trying to side with China here, but the logic is pretty strong.
Well, what do you think of this? So I got confused earlier, but the reason why I was confused is because I was reading about the New START with, you know, the Obama deal with Russia. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. that's expiring in 7 months.
Right.
What Trump wants to do is that he wants to include China into that deal. And this is a nuclear deal.
Right.
It is an arms control deal, which would essentially, it would limit the amounts of nuclear arms, but China's stockpile is not even close to the size of Russia or the United States.
No, but they also don't have restrictions on building more either. So, like, generally speaking, I'd have to read the contents of the deal that they're trying to iron out. And in most cases, I think a lot of the deals that they try to iron out are fucking stupid. But the general idea to impose more like nuclear arms restrictions sounds like a good fucking idea to me.
But it's just the incentive wouldn't really be there for China as much because their stockpile, because they're going to put limits that obviously the China is going to be way below.
Right.
And they're not going to put limits that are going to, you know, debilitate our own nuclear arsenal to a point.
I mean, it's possible that those limits would be relative to the country, you know? So, like, our limits would be higher than China's limits because we already have more than you do, you know? It's possible that they'd draw up something like that, but there's no way that China would agree with it.
Trump seems to be very keen on getting them in this deal. He wants them in this deal.
I mean, without reading it, like without reading the contents, I kind of support this because right now there's a lot of escalation. And, you know, we've been talking about the American plans, you know, to combat China, but, you know, this new report came out recently. This is the kind of the last thing that I wanted to talk about, but there's an internal Chinese report that China's basically facing a Tiananmen-like global backlash over the coronavirus, and they're actively planning contingency plans up to and including armed conflict with the United States. So it's not just us. You know, they're thinking about it too. You know, this whole pandemic has been pretty crazy, and you know, basically they're saying that the rising wave of hostility of the coronavirus outbreak could, you know, push them to armed conflict with the United States. And so it was originally drawn up by this organization called the Institutes of Contemporary International Relations.
That sounds like some neocon shit right now.
It is. Like, it's like, hey, Chinese neocon, hey, shit.
So like it's like on the U.S. side though, because you know, the U.S. is China is so embarrassed and they're facing so much hostility because they did coronavirus that they feel like they're backed. They're like a fox backed in a corner, and they're gonna end up lashing out. So we got to take them out now. That's what it sounds like to me on my side. Yeah, I'm sure China has their own hawks as well, their own like people who think of unreasonable solutions for what they need to deal with right now. Because I mean, frankly, the virus did come out of there. I think that what they're really gonna suffer is you know, they're the manufacturing powerhouse that's in China is going to transition to countries in Southern Asia. I think that's going to be the long-term consequence. Like Vietnam will benefit from this. Maybe Cambodia will benefit from this. You know,
yeah, likely.
South, in the South. Like those are going to be the main benefactors because people are not going to want to have their, you know, manufacture iPhones and manufacture shit there.
I mean, likely, but again, I want to point out that this is like an internal like document. This is like their neocons talking about this. So the, again, the institute is the China Institutes of Contemporary International Relations. I'm never going to say that again. It's basically a think tank. And it's affiliated with the Ministry of State Security, which is China's top intelligence agency. It happened early last month. They presented their findings to top leaders, including their president, Xi Jinping. Basically said that anti-Chinese sentiment is at its highest since 1989, which was the Tiananmen Square crackdown. And it basically called for the need to be prepared for a worst case scenario for like an armed confrontation with the United States. And basically like the United States has been putting a lot of pressure on China. I don't think this is unfounded conclusion. You know, we've been saying for even before the coronavirus that, you know, they've been doing unfair trade practices, unfair technology practices. We've been disputing with them over Hong Kong and Taiwan. And territories in the South China Sea.
Corporate espionage.
Yeah. I mean,
that's not even predatory lending, but that's more like in African countries and European countries.
Right.
But there's a lot of things. Obviously, they're what's going on in Hong Kong with them trying to extradite. Did you know that Animal Crossing was banned there? Side note.
Yeah, it was because people were using the message boards inside of it to like do anti-Chinese like shit. Which I think is really funny that they their free speech is so repressed that people have to take to Animal Crossing to get the message across.
China's war on cartoon animals.
Well, I mean, they already have one war against one cartoon animal. It's Winnie the
Pooh.
Yeah,
Winnie the Pooh. So they have to continue that war.
That you and Peppa the Pig. They don't like Peppa the Pig either. I don't know why. I forget about that one.
They just think he's a disgusting animal.
Anyway, and so like kind of continuing on that, like Trump has been talking about raising, tariffs, new tariffs on China. His administration has been considering doing some other retaliatory measures against China because of the outbreak. You mentioned one before, you know, defaulting on Chinese loans. There's a whole suite of shit. So I don't think that necessarily they're wrong about the anti-Chinese sentiment. They're definitely getting a lot of it. Where I think they're wrong is like their proposal to, you know, consider armed conflict with the United States. I think that'd be fucking terrible.
Well, here's the thing though. There's so much market interest in China still.
Right.
You know, where you have the NBA making deals in China and you have Disney making deals in China. There's so much right. corporate interest in China because there's billions of people there that are potential consumers of your products.
Right.
I think that interest will that corporate interest would honestly prevent a hostile military action.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't really think there's necessarily a lobby the MIC is always pushing for more weapon sales, but
right.
I don't think even they really want a actual conflict with China, just because right. it would be so harsh.
Maybe, but there's another dimension, like a deeper dimension that I think we're not really discussing, and that's the Belt and Road Infrastructure Development Project that China's doing. There's a huge consumer base in China, and there could be corporate interests that would, you know, dissuade Chinese military offensive or defensive, frankly, you know, against the United States. But more importantly, China's getting anti-China sentiment from outside of the United States as well, right? And their big infrastructure project, the Belt and Road project that we've discussed over several different podcasts, and just to catch you up in case you weren't, you're just joining us for the first time, basically China wants to recreate the Silk Road, right? And what they're doing is they're creating huge infrastructure projects to link up through land bridges, Henry's favorite word, roads, across Central Asia and through to Europe, so that they can establish better supply chain, better like global exporting, because they're a huge export economy. And right now how they export things is, like, if they want to export something to Europe, they have to, like, fucking swim all the way around, you know,
literally under swim.
Yeah, they swim over all the way under, like, India and shit, and, like, go up either around Africa or through the straits, you know. So it takes a fucking long time, right? It would be just much easier to set up, like, a rail system or, like, a trucking road system straight through, like, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, you know, other Central Asian countries, and then just get right into Turkey and, like, fly right into Europe. That would be economically more viable to them, and they're investing billions, if not trillions of dollars on this initiative. And if they're getting hit from all over the place, you know, including the United States, but other countries as well, it threatens this. Right. And they're very, very threatened right now in this report that Washington is going to step up our financial support and military support for their regional allies, which would make, you know, their security situation, but also their project kind of volatile. And so there is historical precedent for this, too. After the Tiananmen Square aftermath, the U.S. and a lot of Western governments imposed huge sanctions against China, including banning or restricting arms sales to China, and banning technology transfers. Right. So, you know, if we take this in summation, right, anti-Chinese sentiment because of coronavirus, you know, really threatens not only just, you know, from the United States, but kind of from a global perspective. And it's not just because they have consumers, but it's because they're investing heavily in infrastructure projects outside of their country to bolster their export economy, right? And if that is at all, if the confidence in that is at all undermined, it really fucking throws a wrench in their system, which is backing them into a corner. And they are thinking about, you know, armed conflict with the United States because of it. It's pretty nuts, you know. And they've been doing all they can right now to you know, propagandize that they're somehow the heroes of this. I mean, they've been trying to basically prop up their propaganda around the fact that they're donating a lot and that they're selling medical supplies, you know, to the United States, but also, you know, other countries, and, like, sharing their doctors and their expertise on the virus, and they're trying to, like, do a bit of PR there.
I mean, they went and they saved Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, apparently they did.
he's alive, by the way.
He's alive because of them.
Spoiler alert. You don't have to listen to our last episode now.
Yeah. Well, it's all bullshit. Don't listen to it.
we said that he wasn't dead, what, like, 2 minutes into it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely knew he wasn't dead. There was no way that he was dead, and we didn't know about it already. But yeah, I mean, this is like real shit that's going on right now in China. And, you know, between COVID-19 and between, you know, us pulling out our missiles from Saudi Arabia and basically, in a nutshell, moving them to Asia Pacific, it's kind
diverting them somewhere and then putting more missiles there. We don't know if they're right. The same missile system.
No, they're, like, definitely
the same
not
serial numbers. Like, but let's just, for the visualization, right, let's just paint it that way, where they actually shipped those forces, like in a board game or something. Like, I will take my piece and move it to
Knight
South Pacific.
To E4.
Oh man, I watched the entire marathon of that the other day.
Yeah,
and it was, honestly, pretty great. Does not ever get tired.
No, definitely.
Yeah, man, that's fucking is kind of crazy.
We'll see what comes out of it. You know,
I we'll see what happens. We'll see if a war breaks out. if a war breaks out, we'll let you guys know.
Yeah.
You'll hear it first. You'll hear it from bro history first if there's a war between U.S. and China.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I mean, It's so. Right now, I'm in a position where I'm still like. I think we're all in this position. Nobody knows what's going on, even in their respective industries and fields. Like, you could be a practicing, you know, a primary care doctor, who does not know what the fuck's going to happen to your practice or to your industry, and you're in healthcare.
Right.
The banks don't know what the fuck's going to... They have no... So... I want to do a quick follow-up on some of the episodes that we've been doing regarding a lot of the loans and the stimulus packages that the U.S. has been giving out. So there was this New York Times article that was released today, and it's titled, "Small Business Counting on Loan Forgiveness Could Be Stuck with Debt." And I'm sure you guys if you've been listening to the past couple episodes, we've been talking a lot about these PPP loans, these paycheck protection loans that have been part of the stimulus package and been given to banks to give to businesses that are currently locked down to pay their staff. But essentially, you know, they're supposed to be grants if those companies, those businesses, use that money to pay their staff even though they're not at work. So you're like, you know, you're paying for no productivity. So there's been a couple of issues that are outlined in this article. One of the, you know, the first issue that jumps out to me, which we discussed, is that people are making more money on unemployment right now than they would in these service industry jobs. So they don't want to go back to work, first of all. So it's like, no, we don't want to go back. Like, what's the point? Like, I rather get money. Let me wait till the unemployment dries out, and then I'll go back to work. But now there's – so first of all, the banks don't even know what's going on because they were the amount of applications that have been going in through these banks to get these loans have been so astronomical that – a lot of these smaller community banks that have been issuing out these loans don't have the infrastructure to actually deal with this. So there's like no application process. There's no like really underwriting process for these loans. Now, what's ambiguous is the requirements to not get, I guess, penalized from the federal government because
not get dinged.
You're getting money that is supposed to be a grant that's supposed to go to your employees, and at 70% I think is supposed to go to the employees, and then, you know, 30% can go to other expenses. That might be impossible because you're supposed to pay those employees in a certain period of time. The date runs up in the next week, so you have a finite period of time to pay these employees. And again, there's no really guideline, and business owners are not sure what they're doing, if it's illegal or not. And apparently, all these businesses that are going to be getting these loans are going to be audited too. So they're like, what the fuck do we do? So what they're doing, a lot of businesses are doing right now is that they're getting these loans and they're just putting them in their bank account, and they're probably just going to give them back. They're not even going to use the loan. So they're just going to take the debt and they're going to pay it back because they don't know what to do and just not hire their staff back until the lockdown is over. But then at that point, like, there probably won't be enough demand for employment for those people to get their jobs back at their previous employer. So it's just this paycheck protection program is a complete shit show. It's a shit show. And I think anyone should have fucking saw how big of a shit show this was going to be because of how fast they did it. Like, all right, everyone's locked down. Money. Give them trillions of dollars. All right. $500 billion to work. All right. Give them another $300 billion. It's just like tossing money and just throwing money at these problems. And, I mean, first of all, a lot service-based businesses typically our paychecks away, our rent checks away from going out of business.
Right.
Like the margin, the profit margins in the restaurant or the retail industry or a lot of these small businesses that people are kind of thinking of when they think of, like, you know, getting bailed out because it's not their fault. It's very, very, you and I both know that most of these businesses fail anyway. And sometimes it's not of their own fault. It's just a very, very competitive market in the restaurant industry, in the service industry, in the hotel industry, in the hospitality. They're very competitive markets with low margins. So a lot of these people who are taking out these loans are going to be stuck with the debt in the long run. And even if they pay out their employees over this time, when doors do open and when there's less lockdown restrictions, they're going to have, from what it looks like, no one knows for sure. Who knows? Maybe there's a miracle of people wanting to go to restaurants when this is all over.
Honestly, have you been outside recently? It feels like there's a miracle for people wanting to go anywhere right now.
That's fair enough. I'm sure there's going to be some businesses that make ahead. Like they're gonna make a lot of money. I think it's gonna be a lot of businesses that appeal to younger demographics are gonna be the ones that are going to really do well. Maybe that have a lower price on the menu, you know, or not, you know, like a place that has a $18 glass of wine will probably not do as well.
You mean place like with like $5 like Bud menu? Lights.
McDonald's. Not a dollar menu, but like I think the places that are going to do well are going to be like the divey kind of bars that, you know, people go to grab drinks or watch games and things like that. Especially if this happens before football season, I think those types of restaurants will rebound. I think the ones that will fail will be like the ones with like super high prefix menus. Like, I don't think that people are going to want to go to those or want to spend the money on those, but who knows? I mean, I guess you could look at the, you know, the industries that did well after the, you know, the recession, our last major recession, and see how they bounce back. But I mean, this is a whole different animal because it's, you know, this is a pandemic virus, not just the recession.
Right.
I don't know. It's crazy, man.
My two cents on this is, like, I know that you and I don't totally agree on you know, the money that we've used to stimulate our economy and make sure that it doesn't completely bust. I think we both agree on the way that it was carried out. Like, I would agree that, you know, we're like, we understood we needed to put money to solve some of these problems. But just like how they decided to do it was a fucking nightmare. And I think part of this problem, again, I'm not an economist, but part of the problem for me is that, you know, these PPP loans were basically like trickle down economics, you know, at a massive scale with a massive, you know, with a velocity that was just ridiculous, right? So they were just like, we will give you business a loan and you must pay your people the money, most of it, by I don't know what date, and also maybe you don't owe us, but maybe you do, you know. So like the incentives on paying your employees was unclear, you know, the parameters and the rules there was unclear. And but the idea was, if we give these loans to these businesses, then they can pay their people, and then, you know, the people ultimately don't lose their jobs and they can, you know, have financial security. They should have just skipped the middleman and said, if you're a person, here's some money. And if you're a business and you just need to keep your doors open, like pay your basic bills, here's money for that. Not like try to funnel the money to the people through a, you know, through the business. That was, in my opinion, doomed to fail.
I mean, if they were going to do anything, you might as well just put money in people's pockets.
Yeah, like, that's what I'm saying. People's pockets.
Yeah, like just put it. If you were gonna put a stimulus bill, and like not have like these. And I'm not saying I'm endorsing this. I'm just saying this would be better than the system that we put in place.
Exactly.
Like
yeah.
You might as well just put a bigger stimulus check in someone's bank account,
right?
Based off what their
or
tax
just a more consistent stimulus check,
rather than rather than like have this go through a bank with like a kind of a weird application process. And, you know, there's so many different types of businesses that you don't know what businesses are actually closed down or what can't do work. And, you know, there's other businesses that have independent contractors that work for them and don't have full-time staff. But, you know, the independent contractors may as well be their staff because they could be hired and fired at any time. Like, you know, they still report to that person. Like,
it's like, do you pay them? Do you not pay them? Like, what?
Don't pay, like, they're being – so it's just such a shit show. And – to top it all off is that a lot of like large companies, there's publicly traded companies have applied for these loans as well. And we went over this, I think two episodes ago, we went over all the bullshit of like all these like companies that are either
cheaters,
have been public companies, cheaters have had, who have been, had fraudulent activity, who have lied to investors regarding their, regarding
their financial
returns,
financial
health, have received money for these loans. And, you know, when they got some of them, like a company like Shake Shack, which has a million locations that does pretty well and you would think would have some savings, you know, a rainy day savings for a crisis like this, they ended up being humiliated and having to give the money back. A lot of businesses are going through that process. But it's too easy to take advantage of because everyone's going to want to get a piece of that pie. Most larger banks are going to prefer their larger customers as well. So, you know, a Bank of America or a Chase, they're going to prioritize their business accounts that are
doing well.
that are doing well. So, you know, as far as like these mom and pop shops, like, you know, Jim's Subways or Jim's Subways, Jim's Subs, or Jim's Meatball Shop. I'm making up a generic restaurant name. I'm having a tough job. They're going to have to go through probably a different process than where they would normally get a loan. And it's like a new, it's going to be tough. Like, it's going to be like a whole new process.
And the employees of Jim's Meatball Shop are like, you know, at the very bottom of this terrible, shitty stick, you know, because, you know, what do? Do they, will Jim pay them? Won't Jim pay them? It really just depends on how Jim does at his bank. And if Jim gets the money from his bank, does Jim know that he doesn't have to pay that money back later? Can Jim effectively pay out all of his employees in time to meet the minimum requirements?
And is that enough for the lockdown?
Exactly.
Like,
that's isn't
like
enough?
How we don't even know when Jim's Subway can open again. So what does it matter if he pays them for a month or two?
Right.
Like, what does it fucking matter if they're not going to get a paycheck down the road? Mm-hmm. Like, it makes no fucking sense. Like, this whole fucking bill, this whole fucking plan, it was retarded. Like, I just don't get it. Like, I understand the need to act. Like, you know, politicians are going to want to act when there's a crisis, and you're going to want to be like, okay, we got to, you know, we got to put some type of funnel money into pockets and all this stuff. But they did it in such a dumb way.
Yeah.
It did make it more complicated where people are scared to even use the money. Like, it's just a joke.
Yeah. Like you said, the easiest way would have just been putting money in people's pockets, which is what I was in favor of the entire time. And it looks like actually they're trying to draw up another multi-billion, perhaps trillion-dollar bill for a second wave of stimulus. And apparently the Republicans are obviously trying to block this. But they won't sign off on anything because Trump wants to include a payroll tax cut for this, which when you just like think about that for a minute, like how the fuck would a payroll tax cut help people when people are out of work? Like, you know, like if you're not getting a paycheck, how is that supposed to benefit you? You know? So just really fucking stupid.
It's government, man. It's government. Like, like, what do you think they're going to think of? Like, they're not going to think of, like, something well thought of. It's politicians need to act and look good. So they make very, very tough choices very quickly without much research, and that's how you get these inefficient spinning builds. It's basically like, this is my favorite analogy. I heard it from Peter Schiff. It's like taking a blood transfusion from your left arm and putting it into your right arm, and then spilling blood as you move the syringe. Like, it's just, I don't know. I'm kind of just speechless and very and very frustrated about what's going on. And
a listener here, or a viewer, Bora, says, should I invest in war stocks? Probably.
I mean, war stocks always go up. I mean, why not invest in Boeing, Lockheed Martin,
Raytheon,
or Boeing?
Lockheed Martin.
Hey, look, hey, yeah. Boeing is perfect. Boeing is getting bailed out.
Right.
And guess what? Boeing's planes fall out of the sky. So that's, I mean, if you call that fucking bulletproof, like, you know, Lockheed Martin's F-35 costs $1.4 trillion. That weapons program, $1.4 trillion. $1.4 trillion program. And there's been many issues with those planes. Like, many, many issues with those planes.
Nevertheless, and I bet if we looked at their stock right now, it's probably fine.
What is it?
Let's find out. I can tell you right now.
And you know what? Here's another thing. I was watching CNBC, and bald head Kevin O'Leary comes on from Shark Tank, Mr. Wonderful.
Uh huh. Oops. Looks like we had some technical difficulties. Apparently, my mic unplugged, and well, you're not going to hear the last 10 minutes of this episode. But if you're interested and you want to hear us rant about Kevin O'Leary and our opinions about buying war stocks, you should check us out on YouTube and watch the live stream there. As always, like, share, subscribe, rate, and review the podcast if you're on Apple. We'll see you guys next week.